You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, my name is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network. Today, I have two guests, two filmmakers with really important films that could have been made yesterday, but they were not. And so I'm excited to delve into conversation with them. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Everett and Dennis Leroy Kengele.
Thank you. Lovely to be here with you, Tanya.
Yeah, same here, same here.
Lovely, lovely to be here.
So, you know, I'm making my first film, so I applaud you both for making one. Christopher Everett has a documentary called Wilmington on Fire about a massacre in 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, that I honestly had never heard of until getting prepared to meet Christopher today. And Dennis Leroy Kengele, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are.
Or because it could be Kengele.
You're hitting it. I've been called a lot of things in my life, Tanya. You could say it a lot worse, boy. Let me tell you. No, thank you. Kengele is right. Yes, which actually means the dispossessed. It's a Senegalese term, and well, my family's from Trinidad.
Okay.
So in Trinidad, the term had sort of been merged with some of the Indian patois. So Kengele actually means the wretched.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the therapist once, if I knew that, you know, 25 years ago, I could have saved myself a lot of therapy and a lot of money.
That explains a lot, Dennis.
It's all in my name.
So Dennis Leroy Kengele's film, written, directed, and starring also, is called As an Act of Protest. So Dennis, this telling me that your name is about the dispossessed, wretched, the film, mm-hmm. Oh my God, it was painful. It was really, painful. Some beautiful performances. I know as an artist why you would create it, but I want to know, now at the end I saw it was made, was it 2001 or 2012?
Tell me, 2001, yeah. I was editing the movie actually, literally right before 9/11.
Okay.
So we had shot it in January of 2001 after the weird election then that occurred when Bush Sr. had come in again. No one knew what was going on. If you guys remember all that weird time. So that January we shot the film, and it took me about a good 6-7 months just to edit the movie. And, by
yourself 2001. Well?
Yes.
Did you edit yourself as well? Okay.
Yes. I worked with an editor, but I was editing. Back then, it's funny. I feel so old, but the first Final Cut Pro system had just come out at the tail end of the 90s, and it was really user friendly. I'm not very technical at all. As an artist in any way. So technology, it takes me a very long time to sort of adapt to it. I was also more of a theater artist. I was a theater director for many years. My background is in theater. I went to Juilliard for a couple of years. But making the transition into filmmaking was relatively easy. And that version of Final Cut Pro was very simple. That's all I remember about the editing process then. I mean, very easy. And we were still using tape. You know, we shot it on mini DV, and we would put the output onto VHS. So we'd watch it back on VHS. That was the only way we could see what we were doing. But
interesting that you bring up Final Cut Pro, because I'm here in Seoul finishing the edit on my film Red Pill, and my editor, who can work in every system,
yes,
her system of preference is Final Cut 7, which is a legacy system that there's no longer any support for. But you know, Zhang Mong Lee, I think, who cut Parasite, still cuts in Final Cut 7.
Okay.
Love it, because they said it is the closest digital resemblance to you know, paper and scissors, that you can and move things around. What about your editing process for Wilmington on Fire, Christopher?
Well, it's similar to the same thing. You know, we made Wilmington on Fire. We shot everything digitally. We shot on the DSLRs, Canon 5D and Canon 7D DSLR cameras. We edited in Final Cut. I think it was Final Cut 10. I think it was
Final Cut Studio, the one that everybody hates.
that's what we used to cut that. And so, yeah, we had the premiere of it November, 2015. And but yeah, we used the DSLR cameras digitally and cut it Final Cut Pro. The one that you said everyone hates, but the guy that edited the film, that's what he always uses. He always uses Final Cut. That's his go-to thing. So he's always, whenever Final Cut comes out with something, he can't stand Adobe Premiere for some reason. So he always uses Final Cut. That's his thing.
Yeah, no, we're all Final Cut here. Now I'm going to ask you, Chris, you've got, historical footage. Wasn't that a very costly thing, getting all the rights to all that footage?
Well, the footage, really didn't have historical footage. It was more historical, photos and documents.
That's still things that people own. And what was the rights situation about that?
Well, some of the stuff we got, it was from people's personal collections.
Well, you knew personally, like, so you could get a release from them.
Yeah, so they a lot of folks just signed it over to us and just willingly let us use it for free or real cheap, because they were all waiting for a project like this to come along where they can actually use this stuff and really get the story out. But the State Archives in North Carolina, they had access to a lot of stuff. I had a connection with the Cape Fear Museum in Wilmington. They had a lot of stuff. Nice. So just my own connections, I was able to get a lot of stuff for very cheap or a lot of stuff on the free. Certain things kind of cost a lot, like certain newspaper articles.
Yep.
They probably ran me about $250 a piece for like worldwide rights.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
At all.
Thousand, whatever. So luckily with this project, we kind of, we were lucky. We're getting a lot of archival stuff on the cheap.
So both of you were, for people who are listening, I'm going to let the gentleman say, but I want to say that for you to be really re-releasing these movies right now in this moment, they're right in the zeitgeist. We may know our own history, but Tulsa just coming into American awareness because of Watchmen and Lovecraft Country. The fact that we do have these digital cameras that everyone carries around all the time. And even though Black Lives Matter has been around for 14 years, this has been the year that it has seen, the most attention that it had ever had, even though that's already beginning to wane. What I'm going to say, and I'm going to let you speak, is what was hard for me about watching as an act of protest was that it was like, I live this every day. I don't know. I don't really want to watch this. I don't want to watch this. This is my life. So painful. Beautiful performance by Che Allende. As a creator, I was reading some of your biographical information, and it talks about how you just like to be radical and raw and in your face. Like, what was your goal for an audience to experience? Because it's hard.
It's hard, I suppose. I mean, I don't know. It's always tricky. And I always go back to music, which I wish I'd had the proclivities for, Tanya. I'm not. I dabble in music. I play around in music. I'm not a musician, though. I love music, and I've always been very, 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 very conscientiously inspired by American protest music, mm-hmm. folk mm-hmm. music, and early rap mm-hmm. in particular.
Last poets are in jazz. In the film.
Yeah, of course, who are in the film. And I really wanted to find ways of taking some of what you hear in some of, you know, it's like Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn, right? It's like, you know, you listen to that and you think, man, what would that be like if an actor
was expecting that kind of jaunty song, like dun 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 dun.
Of course, and there's a lot of humor.
You know, Mississippi Goddamn. If you aren't listening to the words, you could think it was a polka or something like that. No one,
of course, she makes it very funny. She makes it very, you know, she makes it very humorous. But there's a lot of blood, quite literally, that an artist like her really sheds and shares. I remember when I was making the movie, I thought, well, you know, if Chuck D was going to make a movie, or if, like, you know, The Clash or, you know, one of the great punk bands were going to make a fucking movie, what would they do and how would they do it? And how would they really try to be aggressive to the audience in a way that was honest and in a way that seemed almost like it was a nightmare? I mean, I often laugh nowadays because, yeah, the movie does seem more relevant almost now than it did when I was making it. I made it in the late, you know, I started it in the late 90s, early 2000s under Mayor Giuliani in New York City. And anyone who's old enough to remember him as a mayor will remember that every other week in New York, there was an issue about a black man in particular who had been abused or killed by the cops. And it was like this ongoing thing in the 90s. And I remember by the late 90s, I kept thinking, why aren't theater artists or film artists really getting into it? Why are we not showing that? Or why are we not creating our own
institutions that are run by white people? And that was not of interest to them.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I just had a reading at North Carolina Black Rep of a play where someone got killed on stage. And of the 3 years of developing it, people kept saying, oh, don't put that on stage. But then in 2019, there were a couple of plays at Lincoln Center where black men were killed on stage. And so, oh, now it's de rigueur. They're allowing that to happen. But when you were doing that, that was like, no, we don't want to see that. We're not doing that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember even, listen, I remember even when I was at Juilliard, part of the reason I left was because of that reason, obviously. I mean, I didn't want to necessarily be a classical actor. I appreciated what I learned from them in my first year, but by my second year, I realized, well, this is not really for me, and I'm more interested in trying to figure out how Amiri Baraka can be palpable and relevant to my generation, right? And who I was, what, 22, 23 in the mid-90s. So I was already trying to figure that out there. And everyone kept saying, oh, well, you know, that stuff is not relevant anymore. So there was a lot of ideological, obstacles when I was in my 20s, which may not exist now. I mean, now it's kind of fashionable to talk about racism.
Well, the president says we're not going to be talking about that anymore because that's child abuse.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Do we have a president? Oh, is that what?
No, I mean, I want both of you as black men, because I can never speak to the black male experience.
Yep.
Tell me, yeah, I know yeah, what it's yeah, like yeah. for me to watch black men getting killed on screen, and I know that it's happening to black women. They just don't get the press.
Yes.
What is it like for you, gentlemen, every day to be a black man in America? I mean, your film definitely captures it, but.
Well, you know, Chris and I talk about this all the time. It's a moral problem, you know. I mean, the idea of just, first of all, seeing images of violence against black bodies in general is very disconcerting. Now, America
absolutely has a like fetish. Lynching postcards.
It does. You know,
that's what it is.
Absolutely.
They love it. It is a fetish.
They love it.
They love it.
It's a fetish. They love it. Hollywood adores it. I'm sorry. Without the Nazis or lynchings, Hollywood would be nothing. That I always say this. Two things Hollywood loves: World War II, Adolf Hitler, anything about that, and black men, particularly in the deep down South, in the plantation, getting whipped or lynched, or of course the black woman getting raped by the white, you know, slave master. Hollywood has a fetish for that. And these were some of the issues, of course, that went into me wanting to make a film about this, about writing roles for black men, again, in particular, that where we could be cerebral and emotional and conscious of what's going on and be like how I am in my everyday life. I mean, Chris and I have wonderful conversations, and I always say to Chris, all I want to do is write scripts that are like the way we talk at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It is like almost 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And share that. I want to share that with the world, you know, and so that's where it becomes this terribly moralistic problem. I do not like, I mean, you can only see so many images of black men getting, you know, being in a chokehold, getting shot, having a cop put his knee on your back, right? All the images we constantly see. And although people claim that the more you see it, the more it will help change the world, I disagree with that. I think you
are
need
you in North Carolina?
What is that?
So what is it for you guys down
North
there?
Carolina.
I mean, New York, we're kind of the bad people of America. You're in the heart of America.
Well, yeah, you know, down here, you know, I was born and raised in the South. You know what I'm saying? Here in North Carolina, especially raised in a small country rural town called Laurinburg in North Carolina. So, you know, I saw a lot of racism growing up. I mean, my first experience was I was just jogging in my neighborhood, you know, because I was an athlete.
Chris was an athlete, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was, you know, trying to work hard and go jogging.
And you can't jog, Chris.
Right. And that's
that
was my first.
That, now. Yeah.
That was my first lesson of not jogging in your own neighborhood. Police officers.
What happened? Tell us, because jogging.
Yeah, police officers pretty much came out of nowhere and held me up for hours. Pretty much thought that I was someone that was doing illegal activities, selling drugs and all, you know,
running from
because I was running.
Right.
Right. But I had basketball shorts on, you know, sweating because I've already ran like two or three miles, you know. So when, you know, I would see these type of things happen as I got older, it will always make me, you know, think about, you know, growing up. And it goes back to the whole thing of what Malcolm X used to say, you know, you're not down south. You know, if you're under the Canadian border, you're down south. So whether it's New York, North Carolina, the largest city or the biggest, or the smallest city, it's all the same. It was being, especially being a black man in America. And so I think that's why I connected. Yeah, same. Yeah, just black people in general,
of course, men or women. Yeah.
And so that's why I try to do, you know, that type of work as well in regards to my films. And with Wilmington on Fire, you know, I would always hear about Rosewood when that film came out by John Singleton. And, you know, you hear about Tulsa, but it was something that happened similar right here in my home state of North Carolina that was very significant. And so I said, you know what? I was tired of complaining about Hollywood not making these type of stories or films. So I said, what the hell? I'm going to try it and I'm going to do it. And so I just been having that same spirit ever since of not waiting on Hollywood. And that's why I connected with Dennis. And that's why we get along and still work on certain things.
Yeah.
And we're working on a new project right now together.
Yeah.
Is that, go ahead, Dennis, go ahead and explain.
It's called A Saintly Madness. And I guess, Tanya, in a way, it's almost like a spiritual sequel to As an Act of Protest. In revisiting some of these issues, again, now 20 years later, you know, in my life and in the world, and we're basically trying to do a little ensemble drama that sort of deals with some of the internal conflicts of people on the left and how they want to handle now aspects of revolutionary violence, protest, racism, and it's been a hell of a project. We're shooting in January, and we spent the entire summer in the midst of the George Floyd horror writing the script, and it was not something I wanted to do. We originally, last year, Chris and I were working on a comedy, believe it or not. We were, seriously. It was a satire. It was a good one, but it was a satire. So energetically, I was in a different place. COVID hit. Everything happened. George Floyd, blah, blah, blah. Everyone pretended like racism is something new. So, of course, Chris and I always get caught in that, you know, because anytime a black man gets killed, they either want to screen my movie or Chris's movie, which is terrible. That is a terrible, terrible thing. But this is what America does. I've been saying the same thing for 25 years and no one will listen. And so Chris and I said, well, why don't we make a new film now and really express some of these issues and some of the problems that we both have with the hypocrisy of people on the left? Because that's really my biggest beef.
Like what? Tell me some of the hypocrisy you see. Tell me some of the hypocrisy you see on the
left. In particular, one of the things that get me is that, and Chris and I, again, talk about this all the time, I'm not a firm believer in begging or asking or complaining the system as we know it to change. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm a firm Malcolm X believer when it comes to that. I think you've lost your mind. If you actually really believe that America really cares or wants to be or will change, you're living in la la land. Now, that doesn't mean that things can't change, but if there's a Confederate statue, say, in front of my house, okay, Tanya, there's so many this country is nothing but is one Confederacy. I can't spend all of my time worried about that one statue. What I should be worried about, I think, now as an artist, is how you feel, how Chris feels, how we feel about each other, maybe as black people, and start expressing that. And I also have a lot of real big beef with black cops who seem to now, more than ever, if you notice, are involved in a lot of weird stuff lately. And there's a lot of interesting things that
I don't know what weird stuff they're involved in.
Like the George Floyd issue. I mean, there were four cops who were really involved in that murder. Everyone knows Derek Chauvin, the white guy, the main white guy. I forget the name of the other white guy. But the other two cops, one was Asian and one was black. Now, I said to Chris a while ago, I said, you see, now that would be dangerous if we actually explored that. Because, Tanya, what scares me are not white racists. It's the black people who are colonized who work against us. Those people scare me.
We got a lot of those.
And they've been my biggest problem in my entire, in my life, in the arts, in the art world. It's not white people who've thrown me out of meetings or who won't give me grants. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm 44. I've never gotten any help from anybody in New York, right? It's always been black people who've been who've worked hard against me, people of color who don't want to appear, quote unquote, too angry. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. So it's all of that. And right. I think that that's absolutely, I mean, that's some kind of Franz Fanon nightmare. And I really do believe that we need to kind of get into that. And
but yeah. I'm gonna push against you, because there's a way in which I agree with you. I think that there's a way in which I feel like the only reason we go to white people is because they have these keys to gates and they have all the resources.
Yes, but
as Chris Everett's film points out, we have done it ourselves again and again and again.
When
emancipation ended, there were 4 million black people who were released into a capitalist economy with zero capital. And we rose to be some of the most successful people in the world in every industry.
Now think about that.
And every time we do, they come in and destroy it. Chris, I want you to speak to that.
Oh yeah, 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 totally. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the film, is to really, because I didn't realize until I got older about a lot of those accomplishments, especially coming out of slavery, and how we turned around our whole educational achievement coming out of slavery and starting businesses and starting, you know, black business districts and becoming, you know, industry leaders as well and doing our thing. But the downside of that is that the government never really protected us. You know, we paying taxes and doing all this stuff, but we never got the equal protection under the law. And I've always...
Right, the law has never protected our business, our home, our property.
Right. And, you know, and that goes back to what we talk about in Wilmington on Fire is really the case for reparations, you know, because of that. And I know the film has been mentioned even last summer the whole congressional hearing on reparations.
The only film mentioned.
Yeah, it's the only film, Wilmington on Fire. So a lot of people have been really using the film to help push for the case of reparations, because, you know, it really shows that whole the whole period of racial terror, you know, after the Reconstruction.
Racial terror is ongoing. Okay, exactly. Racial terror is ongoing. It has never ended. What I'm asking you all is, we have right now, why would we even think that they would ever allow us to have without bombing us and destroying us again? History has shown us that's what they do again and again and again. So
it's a kind of like Paul Mooney always says, it's like Stockholm syndrome. I mean, we love our oppressors. We keep asking them, hello, hello, will you stop? Will you give me? We have to stop that. I'm not one of those people who believe in that. I believe in doing for self. I believe in self-defense.
Not hearing my question. My question is, I agree with you. So we've got these two sides. We have done for ourselves again and again and again. And every time we do, they destroy it.
Yes.
So with that as the model, the factual historical model, what other options are there?
Well, I think the options really clearly is, you know, learn from history. Yeah, they destroyed it, but, you know, we made some mistakes as well. And I think now we really need to use our votes and also still pull our money together. You know, we can't just say, you know what?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's don't do nothing. You know, we have to try as a people. And there's a lot of things we can be doing better, supporting one another. One, starting more businesses, investing in each other, you know, start going, you know, still take our education more serious, and doing things like that, building businesses, doing what I'm doing. Like I'm distributing Dennis's show. Exactly. No one took a chance on it. Exactly. So just doing small things like that. Exactly. You got one sister right now, she has Quelle TV, black streaming service.
Exactly.
We can support that. You know, so just doing small things.
Yeah.
You know, like that, but just us doing that without always trying just being together
just
and stuff like that.
Simple stuff, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't see it as that simple. I mean, we had this beautiful day when the NBA said we're striking. And I heard someone saying somewhere this past week, they said, if all the ball players just said we're done, they can't replace them. They can't go out and hire a new team. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of white people be like, great, now we can go back to it just being an all white league and we can just watch ourselves play. But I think if the black players all started their own league and just played, I know where the money would be going. I know where the viewers would be going. And yet these men with great wealth and power and privilege went on back.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem. The thing is, honestly, if white people look at it and say, hey, you know, we get to go back to watching white folks play. Honestly, no one really wants to see that.
They don't even want to see that.
So, but I agree with you that we don't realize the power that we have. You know what I'm saying? And to me, our people are the only people that's never really benefited off of our talents, whether it's our athletic talent, our music talent. We've seen it years in the music industry and also now in the film industry as well. You know, we've never really been able to capitalize fully off of our talents and innovations and stuff like that. And I think that we have to have the confidence. I think it's a lack of confidence. A lot of times our people, we aren't confident in ourselves and the ability to do what we need to do. You know,
well, both of you are very confident, so I'm not going to accept that.
I don't think some people do. I know
plenty of confident black people.
And I think there needs to be more.
There's plenty of confident black people. Now, they may not be the ones that the gatekeepers let in.
Exactly, Tanya.
But I think and that's why I just really, and the thing is, you know, that's why I really embraced, you know, being independent. And I think more independent artists need to really embrace that and make that cool again to be an independent artist, man.
Yes.
And really embrace that, you know, and really take that in and own to it, you know, and own it. You know, that I'm an independent artist. I don't really need the system. Yeah, I can collaborate with the system whenever it makes sense.
Of course.
But at the end of the day, we can do our own thing and do it well.
Yeah, I agree.
And both of you are doing that.
This is Tanya Pinkins, and that was part one of my conversation with Joanne Zippel of Zip Creative.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.